All right, everyone, welcome along to another episode of the Martin's World podcast. Guys, welcome along to the show. And if you want to support the show, guys, just to remind you, the patreon.com/Martin's World, or also you can make a donation in the form of bitcoins through martinsworld.ie. All of the funds, guys, will be used to establish a cannabis activist hub here in Cork City to bring together the cannabis activists so we can better socialise and organise ourselves to fight for the cannabis legalisation in Ireland. So, guys, on with the show. Today's guests are, we have two guests, actually. Today we've got Trev Coleman and we've got Steve Harrison. Both of these guys are involved with the Seed Our Future campaign in the UK. And Trev Coleman was recently raided by the cops. He was raided because his house was being broken into. And he lives in Durham, where the Durham police force had kind of giving growers this idea that there was a form of decriminalisation going on and that the police wouldn't be targeting them. And when Trev noticed people were trying to break into his house, he rang the cops, thinking the cops would come and protect him. Unfortunately, no, they didn't. They came and took his cannabis plants off him. So he shares a little bit about that story. And we talk about the Seed Our Future campaign, which is challenging the charges around these cannabis possession charges and cannabis growing charges, because they believe there isn't any justification there. There's no evidence to support keeping cannabis illegal any longer. So they're challenging the charges and they're pushing the Seed Our Future campaign. So it was great to get to chat with the guys and get to learn a bit more about their campaign and what it is that they're actually doing. So without further ado, I give you Steve Harrison and Trev Coleman. Joining us today on Martin's World, we have Steve Harrison. And Steve Harrison, you're with Seed the Future and Weed the Undersigned, is that right?
Seed Our Future, I'm the director role to help Guy Coxall and Trev out with moving that campaign forward. I'm involved with WTU other than a supporter and a good friend of Phil Monk, who's leading WTO. So there's kind of an interface between the two organizations because of the cannabis directives, yeah. You know. So certainly keep ear to the ground with WTU and support that campaign. And so too now is stepping up the Seed Our Future to try and get things over the line.
Definitely two campaigns the community are very much need to be aware of. And Trev, then you're joining us today. Trev, I became aware of yourself more recently with a post on Facebook after you unfortunately had a visit from, I can't remember the name of the police force, but they effectively a couple of years ago said that they weren't going to be targeting people like yourself. And they kind of went against their word then. So, and your future campaign as well.
I'm actually one of the authors of the Seed Our Future campaign. Now, what you're talking about there with Durham Police not targeting personal users, it was me who actually broke that news via Teesside Cannabis Club that all of the nationals jumped all over several years ago. It was me that took Teesside Cannabis Club to Durham Police that's allowed all of the progress in Durham. They even have there's a police back recreational club in Teesside now on the back of all of that. So one of the things I did before I even started growing was to research the charges. I did my due diligence on them. One of the things I went looking for was the evidence that the police used to legislate for cannabis as what is regarded as a Schedule 1 substance, meaning it's got no medicinal benefit and a high propensity for abuse. I spent about 3 weeks looking for that evidence. I scoured every single government website I could. When I couldn't find it, I got in touch with Durham Police and I spoke to Ron Hogg as part of the activities with Teesside Cannabis Club. And I asked him if he could direct us to it. And he said he couldn't. When I asked him why not, he told us because it doesn't exist. When I asked him, surely if somebody asked for that evidence in court and the CPS couldn't produce it, the case would collapse, he agreed with me. So that is the foundations of the Seed Our Future document that everybody has now contributed to. We've contacted every force up and down the country and every force through a freedom of information requests. Every single force has come back saying that they can't provide that evidence. We've also had a freedom of information request from the CPS to say they can't provide that evidence. And we've had one from the Home Office to say that that evidence was destroyed. So there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever anywhere to validate charges against anybody. There never has been. that the police up and down the country are engaged in a system of industrial-scale fraud and state-sponsored terrorism to the letter of the law.
Yeah, and in fact, you could probably provide evidence to the contrary against the cannabis placement as a Schedule One drug, which there's mountains of evidence to the medicinal benefits of it.
Yeah, I already have. As part of my defence pack, I've already sent all of this over to Durham Police, the Police Ombudsman, the Police Federation, and the Police Federation so far have absolutely shit themselves. They don't want to touch us.
Fair enough. And do you think that they targeted you mistakenly, or do you think the new...
No. There was four guys trying to break in. So, being here on my own, there's no way I'm going to be able to take on four guys on my own. So, I called the police.
Okay. So the four guys...
I've been involved with the police for several years. I've done a number of TV appearances, including one with Professor Green, where I had me grow on display for them all. So I've been on national TV for all of this a number of times.
Yeah, I've seen some of those videos, actually. But those four guys, I thought in the post those four guys were undercover police or something, that was the start.
No, just a bunch of little roughs trying to break into my house.
So those were actually people trying to break into the house, and you actually phoned them to come and help you. Assist you.
Yeah.
Scumbags talking.
And they're robbing you. Exactly. So if you think about it for poor Trev, is he's got people trying to break in who the police are there to protect us against. And then when he rings the police come in and turn him over worse than the guys probably would have done for actually breaking in. So we're starting to see the ludicrous reality is how I see it. And a lot of people involved in the cannabis industry, as you know, Martin, Trev, industry and community and you know, consumers, just people who are advocates of cannabis, some people who are advocates and they don't even, you know, all of that's a section of the public, you know, and there's over 2 million of us in the UK, which are kind of like, is the number that gets bandied about, but I can certainly say that's probably a more. Now, under that sort of directive, we have a section of the public which does something which, you know, pre-1920s was used for thousands of years.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden we've got this period of time where, you know, vilification of cannabis comes in the early 30s through the stages of political agendas, corporate agendas, racial agendas. These are what, you know, have stemmed and are the foundation of sort of cannabis legislation. So we have to actually draw a line in the sand at some point and realize that the issues that we are seeing today are not born from our generations. No pun intended, but those, you know, bad seeds were planted many, many years ago, and we are now bearing the bad fruit of those decisions. And we can fix it, we can change it, and that's where Seed Our Future is coming into saying, well, hold on. And how it all sort of came about is, you know, Guy Coxall, our founder, Guy Coxall, a legend in what he's done to bring Seed Our Future to where it's at, and the whole sort of campaign direction we changed when, after Trev and I had a call. So I wasn't heavily involved in the cannabis community until sort of earlier on this year. But I founded a company called Flora Fusion about 4 years ago. But I was watching how I wanted to sit back and watch how things were going to see who was going to take forward the arguments and the challenges. Certainly had that expectation with the CTA in the early days. I thought that's what it would be. But, you know, by and by, we've got time passing and not really a lot has happened. We've had the CBD industry rise, but it's certainly not stable or protected. It's changing all the time. The legislation seems to be coming in to protect, you know, other agendas, as opposed to the fact is, well, we're just trying to get bottles into people's hands who can take it and then change their quality of life. That's the business model for a CBD company, and how well they do that is obviously that comes down to free market opportunity, trade and brand management. We then go into the cannabis community, and we then, you know, we've got the police officers, we've got the law, we've got the courts, all working in, you know, the section of the public, which is a cannabis consumer, a cannabis grower, a cannabis user, we all get vilified and told that we're organized criminal gangs. Anyone that uses cannabis is a criminal. And you kind of, I would say I'd pull my hair out, but I need a barber. But this hair, you know, has you feel like ripping it out of your head for the insanity that it shows. So we have to now stop, have a look at what Trev's been able to present. And that was the three-question defense that Seed Our Future is built on. And the three-question defense is, okay, you say that we're breaking the law. You say that it's harmful. You say that, you know, it's a controlled substance that needs to be, you know, watched with this keen eye because of the damage that it will cause. But we aren't seeing any damage within the community out with the sort of normal side effects that could potentially come, which we know are a lot safer than, say, side effects of certain pharmaceuticals, et cetera. But the only harm we're seeing is through the legislation, kicking people's doors in, trashing their house, dragging parents away from their kids because they're using cannabis. Now, fair enough, if you've got cannabis in a situation which is in a wider sort of context of like they're using cannabis and then they're using the cannabis to buy guns and then the guns are used to then, you know, help towards human trafficking, then, yeah, I mean, cannabis is used and being used for a nefarious purpose. An 80-year-old man growing three plants to help his kidney disease is not in the same ballpark, you know? No. Certainly not a young lad and his mates going around and having a joint, you know what I mean, and trying it out for the first time as opposed to going and getting leathered on a bottle of whiskey. Now, they go there young, they've got the whole life ahead of them, but, hey, man, they're experimenting like we all have at one stage in our life if you are inclined. And then all of a sudden they've got a criminal record. What's that mean?
The worst thing that cannabis can do to you is get you a criminal record, really, and when it boils down to it. There was even a study then there. I was going through it yesterday. It was coming out of Queensland's university, and it was one of these like survey studies following people who use cannabis. But like they had a predefined outcome. It's very easy to tell that they wanted to prove that cannabis does harm, and they used these weird kind of markers of like of where cannabis done harm. Like it was whether they had a job or not, whether they were in a relationship or not, the amount of money they were earning in that job. And they were like, oh yeah, people who use cannabis actually harmed their outcomes in life. And just like, you know, it was a very, like, you could tell.
Putting it back on the person, it's the person's fault. They chose to use cannabis. So therefore the fact that we took their livelihood away, we gave them a criminal record. They no longer have a job and their girlfriend left, and that's all on them, man. Sure. But
if you were to actually ask the person though within that study, like say their outcome in life, where they're at right now, are they happy? Let's say the guy who doesn't have a relationship and he's in a job that was under the threshold that they kind of said was a good job, like that guy was probably quite happy. He was probably doing something he was passionate about, or maybe he was surfing and working a part-time job. Who knows? Like he's living and enjoying life.
I can dismiss that one straight away. Background is all military industrial complex. I went right in 2003 so I could get a security clearance that allowed us to go to work for British Aerospace, the police, GCHQ, Satellite Defense Network, the whole lot. Through all of that, I was completely stoned off my tits the whole time. So working at absolutely top level for the government, within all of their organizations, MPS, CPS, police, even when I was working for the police down in Warwickshire, my project manager, he complained about the standard of the weed down in Warwickshire. So I said I would get his forum. Every Monday morning for 2 months, I was going into Warwickshire Police Station, Royal Empty Spa, and supplying him with his weed.
That is ridiculous.
and the reality we're now seeing, Martin, is like it's the hypocrisy of the law in this, so far as we all know about. The things like the Atkins, May, you know, GW Pharmaceuticals, you know, British Sugar, paradigm, I'll call it, because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense to the way the legislations work. You've got Boris Johnson in 2000 talking about how he's got neighbors who are perfectly respectable who would prefer to smoke a spliff, and what's wrong with that? And he's now our prime minister, yet we're tightening the screws on cannabis.
Yeah.
It smells. It smells bad. It smells really, really bad. Seed Our Future is there to take and put a spotlight on it, you know, put the spotlight on it and make sure people are aware that we are not going to accept this rhetoric from a government who for the last 60 years have terrorized us. And now that we see there's a huge amount of research to support our arguments for a cottage industry, for a regulated pharmaceutical industry, and for a recreational industry. This is what we want, and we won't stop until we get it, because that's the right thing to do. So when we argue in a court, when you go into a court and you're being made to feel like a criminal because you've had a bag of weed on you and they're sitting there looking at you and the police are intimidating, and I've been through it, so I'm not speaking of on someone else's subjective experience. It was what I went through when I was arrested for growing my plant. And you're treated like a second-class citizen. You're treated like a criminal. You may as well be Pablo Escobar to some of them. You know, they sit there and have that thought process, and it just boggles the mind. Non-violent cannabis crimes should be abolished. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Non-violent cannabis crimes should be abolished. They should be removed from people's records. We need to start talking about cannabis in the light that it is, which is not harmful. I mean, what have we got? 453 registered deaths in 25 years. And I can tell you, if we look into those, it'll probably be around the synthetic kinds. Yeah. You know what I mean? The synthetic are all part of cocktails found in the system. Now, 453 in 25 years, 6,800, I can't remember the full stats, forgive me, 6,800 odd people died of alcohol, and 10,800 people died of smoking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In 2018 alone.
Yeah, well, the one thing about cannabis compared to all the other drugs is what the researcher said. It was like about how much it took to kill the mouse. It was like, well, it depends on how you drop the cannabis from, because the only way to kill the mouse was to drop it on him effectively. They couldn't get enough cannabis into the mouse killing him by overloading the system with just the sheer amount they were injecting in.
The LV rating.
The LD, exactly. Cannabis. The LD 50. Mm-hmm. It's astronomically high. It's crazy.
Is it 50 kilos or something like that? You got to smoke 50 kilos in 15 minutes to get the amount of to get a THC toxicity to kill you, you know. Yeah. But let's not discount the potential of of harm that, you know, cannabis hyperemesis is end of that spectrum.
Say, for example, my dad, his dad had passed away because of heart attacks. My dad's still alive. He didn't pass away, but he had a heart attack at a young age. So I'm very aware of like the heart and wanting to be like on top of things. And I'd be always looking into the cannabis and the tachycardia and stuff like that they talk about, the speeding up of the heart rate, because I just want to make sure that I'm not like getting into myself into any trouble. But really, when it comes down to it, it's kind of a psychologically driven thing. The tachycardia, when you smoke cannabis, you become a bit more grounded, a bit more present, and you can hear your heartbeat. And then if you focus on it, that's what causes the speeding up of it. Like, I'm not saying cannabis doesn't cause a speeding up of the heart.
Yeah.
It's when you focus in on it and you start panicking about it. Like, yeah, that happens to people. You kind of freak out. But like for myself, I don't feel at risk for using cannabis, even that I'm in that kind of risk group with the heart.
Yeah.
That's because you're not. If you look at the quotes from John Ehrlichman about the war on drugs, they said that they were going to lie about the drugs. It's as simple as that. Everything they're doing is fraud. The whole reason that they're keeping things the way they are at the minute is simple economics. Now, you go and buy an ounce of weed off the street, you're looking, what, 200 quid on an ounce? But if you're trying to buy an ounce of legal weed, you're looking 400 quid an ounce. That's your economy of debt-based scarcity. Yeah, stuff on the streets, it's quite easily available, £200 an ounce. Yeah, legal stuff, not so easy to get a hold of, £400 an ounce. That's the way they're working. This is why the likes of Theresa May's, Jacob Rees-Mogg's, all the rest of them who have got investments, multi-million pound investments in the cannabis industries, are pushing this legislation. This is why none of us should be scared about challenging charges. Because the only people who are going to lose out are those with multi-million pound investments.
Yeah, I'm glad to see kind of a campaign like this over there that are challenging the law, because I kind of started off a little campaign myself last year. We're going out engaging in a little bits of civil disobedience, going down to the guard station. I brought a pot with some cannabis seeds planted inside it. And I was like, look, there's cannabis seeds planted in here. This is illegal cultivation. I'd like my day in court. And because effectively I want to challenge it on the grounds of human rights or constitution here, that basically the prohibition of cannabis, the prohibition of drugs effectively violates our constitutional rights, our human rights, and there's no justification for it, which is kind of what you're tapping off of the evidence side of things. Crap, have I frozen up on you there, guys?
That's it. I got your back now.
Ah, sweet, yeah. But yeah, what I was kind of saying, I don't know if you heard it all, but I wanted to challenge the law myself here on the same grounds as yourself, but there's no justification for violating our human rights.
100%.
It's not just that, it's what if you actually look at the evidence, what they're actually doing is a terrorism, the war on drugs is a terrorism program. So the letter of the law, it's all ideological, it's all based in politics, it's all based in religious, racial hatred, and it's putting everybody's health at risk. So all of that is a breach of the Terrorism Act 2000.
We're victims of generation gaps. That's what we are here, in the sense of you've got a system, which is, there's a system, it's a systemic issue because it's like a program. So if you think, if we go back to our grandparents' days, even our great grandparents' days, it's a different time, you know. At that, you know, the way people think is different. Obviously, there's a lot more formality. You know, people ostracizing someone from a community was still a thing. You know, people get ostracized now. That's all right. They just move down the road. You know what I mean? There's no and religion. Obviously, as well, plays a big part.
Ostracization caused a lot of damage here in Ireland with the mother and baby homes, you know, where people were ostracized. Oh, no, go on down to the mother or baby home. You had a child out of wedlock.
That's right.
And it was, you see, and so the silence enabled that stuff.
Exactly. So it's those that we've got to put ourselves back into that period and think, right, well, how were they thinking? Why did they do this? And obviously, we can locate the real. We've got the root, you know. So when we ask for the foundation evidence as to seed our future defense, we're not asking them because we want them to show. We know what the evidence is. They're throwing up FOI responses like, oh, well, we don't hold that. Or, well, you know, the best one we got was from the Home Office saying that we destroyed the evidence.
Yeah.
It's like, it's the government's way of saying the dog ate my homework. You know what I mean? Because we're like, well, it doesn't change. It doesn't matter if you destroyed it. You can't. You didn't wipe out history by destroying the evidence, because we've got the evidence too. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing is we're reintroducing the evidence in a light that's like, it's like comprehensive, but not so comprehensive that it becomes too complex. It's very simple. Henry Anslinger, like 1928, is when cannabis was criminalized. Became legal in the UK. Then you've got the 1937 Marijuana Tax Act in the US. So you've got two sort of cross continent, you know, whereby if we look into the research and further, we'll probably find links between the two continents in influencing decisions, because it would have been the same directive on both areas for the rise of petrochem, paper, and, you know, sort of the plastics, as opposed to us, you know, our whole civilizations being built on hemp. Because it's so versatile, it can be used as food, fuel, resources for things like rope and rigging. And we know that in history it was used in the sailing. Henry VIII made it mandatory that you had to grow 2 acres of hemp if you're a farmer, because that was to feed the British Navy against the Spanish threat.
Yeah,
you know, and it was the law. It was the law.
Yeah, it was robbed.
I'm going to correct you there, Steve. You're a little bit wrong on that one. Now, what happened with Henry VIII?
Thanks, Trent.
Henry VIII thing, what happened was, because, in fact, Martin, you guys are suffering from the effects of this to this day. Because Henry VIII the Catholic Church wouldn't give Henry VIII a divorce, he split from the Catholic Church, which created Protestantism, the Church of England.
Yeah.
Now, that cut us off from all trade with Catholic Europe, effectively the Brexit of its day. Now, to get around that lack of trade, what Henry VIII did was to mandate that all farmers had to be farming hemp. Otherwise, they could face up to a six-month wages. Now, the whole reason they did that is because we were making literally everything from it. All our ship's sails, all our ropes, all our claws, everything. Every single ship in the British Navy at the time was also required to carry a cargo of hemp seed wherever they went, because that would be the first crop they laid down. So effectively, all the British Empire was a resource-based economy founded on the backbone of cannabis. Right. Now, what we regard as hemp nowadays, that's 0.2% stuff. That's completely unnatural. It was developed in the 60s to lower the THC levels. If you want to remove the THC cap, that plant suddenly becomes 20 to 30 times more productive. Yeah. So that, again, buys into your economy of debt-based scarcity. If we can't get everything we need from our farmers' fields, we've then got to go to somewhere like Saudi Arabia to get their oil to fill our cars rather than, like I say, going to a local farmer. Now, if I've got a choice between going to fill my car at 50 pence per litre from my farmer rather than £1.30 a nod from Saudi Arabia for oil that's soaked in Yemeni blood, I know which one I want.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
It is interesting. Obviously, some of the first laws around cannabis were that farmers had to grow it because of how resourceful it was. You have to wonder where we would be today if cannabis prohibition ever came in place. Hemp cards took off.
If the drug war never occurred and it was regulated from the start and that people, but obviously, again, we go back to the time, you know, it was how easily people were manipulated. The propaganda against cannabis in the early days is still being felt today.
Yeah.
You can hear it in the voices of those who were the children of the people that were there. So our grandparents and stuff, they were the kids of the guys that were there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So our great grandparents. So there's generation gap. Mm-hmm. But what happens is we fall into what I call the trail horse mentality. You know, if anyone knows horse riding and they know about these horse plantation stuff where you can go and have a ride, the horses get into this kind of routine of the trail that they take. And it's this, you know, they don't deviate. You could, you know, put a child on it and say, hold the reins, the horse will know what to do, right? And that's what's happening with our systems, because we've seen our future only recently. We've started the campaigns of challenging the charges. We've been working with individuals who have been victimized. We've been, you know, supporting them and educating them on the three question defense so that they've got something to go with. And we're also encouraging litigant, you know, LIP, litigant in person, whereby they represent themselves and they represent themselves under the fact that you're right. The information and the evidence supports you. So you can go in and be bamboozled by the system. The lawyer could use a trick. The judge might have no tolerance for cannabis because he's seen it so much and he's just tired of it. But they're not actually going any further than 71. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So they hit 71, motor, that's the law. The law states, cool, prove that. Prove where you got that law from. Because again, we see how we actually haven't gone back. Now in 1971, someone approved motor. They, you know, groups of people agreed that cannabis was a Schedule 1. Where does that come from? Well, it's the 61 UN Convention, isn't it? 61 yeah. UN Convention is the on narcotics is when they scheduled cannabis as a Schedule 1. Before that, the only cannabis laws were built in the Boggs Act in the US. I'd have to go back to my notes for the UK, but the US is the catalyzing continent that forced a UN decision, which then led on to subsequent legislations in on the different continents. So we're actually attacking the root. We're attacking the root of that because it leads back. And when we say the foundation evidence, please provide the foundation evidence. What we are talking about is a 1955 document from Henry Anslinger and his pals to the UN, to the WHO, stating cannabis is harmful and needs to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. Okay. And if you go into the Seed Our Future report, the information's in there, and the 1955 document is the Seed Our Future Defense's silver bullet, because it's got Henry Anslinger's name on it, and nothing we have presented, nothing in that report is fabricated. Everything is from national archives, government websites, or specific legislation. There is no facts in that document which aren't true, mm-hmm. and that's what we're looking for. We want the truth, and if we can get the truth into a jury of our peers, or if we can get the truth into the wider public about what has happened and what has occurred, I'm certainly sure those people who are like, cannabis is bad, when they find out that actually it was a racial, you know, there was racial segregation, racial ideologies, and it was used as a tool against minority groups. I don't think there's a lot of people on this planet in modern day that would suggest that that was actually a good idea.
No, I don't
think. And I mean, who's going to accept racism as the basis of law?
Well, the fact that they used marijuana as the way in which they criminalize it, say, in the States, like, that really goes to show, like, they were trying to be sneaky about it, that they didn't actually bring in a cannabis tax act, because if they talked about cannabis per se, a lot of people at the time actually had cannabis in their medicine cupboards. They didn't have marijuana in there. There was no medicinal marijuana at the time. Marijuana was what the blackies and the Mexicans were smoking. And, you know, cannabis was what your doctor was prescribing you for your pains or whatever it might have been at the time. But
you know, the start of the chopping up of cannabis into different categories, so then we can create the complexity, you know, medicinal cannabis or medicinal marijuana, as it gets called, and you're like, okay, medicinal marijuana, and then you have you know, you've got recreational, and then you have like industrial, and you're like, yeah, what?
Policymakers over here are still talking about cannabis in like, we have hemp, which is the stuff that they make the CBD from. And then we have the medicinal marijuana, and then we have the marijuana narcotic, the dangerous drug. Like, they actually think it's all different, but...
All different things, yeah. It's a shame.
Can I just come back to something that you said before? You were saying about what the world would be like today if we'd never had prohibition. Steve hit on something there, that we're dealing with laws that come from generations ago. However, 12 years before prohibition even happens, Henry Ford, who developed the Ford Model T, which was all made from weed, that was all powered with weed, he commissioned a study that said with only 6% of land set aside for industrialized cannabis cultivation, America would have been completely energy independent without the need for fossil fuels. So right now, all of everything that you're seeing because of the fossil fuel lobby is a direct byproduct of prohibition policies. If we hadn't done the prohibition, we would have been using cannabis as our main energy resource. Everything they're seeing right now, your climate change models, your decrease in biodiversity, all of it is a direct product of prohibition policies. Everybody.
Which right there, Trev, it's quite funny, because when I look back into history, and, you know, I like history anyway, like ancient history right through to modern, you know, not too worried about last week, but you know what I mean? When we talk about cannabis, I always like going back to that day. And it's just funny, the logic that of the way the public can be manipulated so easily, because you had alcohol prohibition, which lasted, what, you know, the however many years, I think 7 or 8. It failed.
2 seconds, sorry. I'm going to tap in there because alcohol prohibition had a massive, massive effect on cannabis prohibition, because you need ethanol to produce biofuels, to combine with your seed oil to produce biofuels. So that, but when they banned alcohol, that affected biofuel production. So because you had no ethanol for your biofuels, they had to go into fossil fuels instead.
Yeah, but if you think about the logic of the people, had eight years of alcohol prohibition, which was quite widely spread. You know what I mean? Alcohol use was widely spread. They said prohibition. What happened? Huge rise in criminality around bootlegging, and the, you know, you've got the rise of Al Capone. You've got the Chicago. You've got the mobs forming because people wanted alcohol. And then before that, you know, society wasn't rife with gangsters and Tommy guns and things like that. But once the alcohol prohibition came in, you've created something that people want and they can't get, which is naturally going to create the human being that's going to want to capitalize on that, and is going to be dismissive of the laws, because it's rather silly, isn't it? It's rather silly saying something that we've done for so long, we're now no longer going to do. And anyone that thinks different and doesn't conform straight away, well, you're a criminal. Well, that's ridiculous. So what they did is they lost that war of alcohol prohibition significantly. So they said, well, this ain't working. And guess what? We all kind of want a drink. They then switched. So they took that and they took something less harmful, more popular, and decided to wage a 60-year war against that. Oh, actually longer. No, 37. So over 89 years. You know, that was the thinking. So why don't we learn from our mistakes? Why didn't they think, okay, well, that's, if we prohibit this, well, we know, because there was racial targeting, the Hearst group, you know, pharmaceuticals. There were motives for vilification of cannabis. But we know that now. We've got data to look at. We can see the harm that's occurred over history. And here we are in 2021, still umming and ahhing. Can we not be that type of human being is my question. Can we just sit there and have the logic and say, well, we tried it this way for so long and it didn't work. It actually got worse. It's getting worse. Let's do it different, you know? And it's certainly within the cannabis community because, hey, if you never want to try cannabis, you never want to see cannabis, you don't have to. You know what I mean? Being legal and available and decriminalized means that people who have a propensity towards cannabis consumption like to grow, love the topic. It's an amazing topic. The endocannabinoid system, the research, the industry, all of that becomes free market and open for us to see a different society. Yet here we are still arguing about it, having to come on. And, you know, the amount of awareness campaigns around cannabis is phenomenal. Seed Our Future is the one that I felt personally about jumping in because it's an action. It's an action group in the sense of, no, we're not going to accept it. And we're not going to sit there and be told over and over and over again that we're criminals when, you know, I'll be speaking to someone who's a joiner in a couple of weeks. He's up for charges because he had a bag on him, but he'll go to work every day. He pays his bills. He looks after his kids, but now he's a criminal. Like, it just makes no sense. And this is coming, and we're being told we're criminals by people who are blatantly using their positions of power in an abusive fashion.
Yeah.
So criminals telling us we're criminals when all we want to do is be able to not worry about being busted for consuming cannabis.
Yeah. All we're asking for through Seed Our Future is evidence that would validate charges. Mm-hmm. If they can't validate the charges, there's no crime.
That's right.
So to
maximize, there's no scientific
the effect of this interview, I suppose, the joiner you're going to be meeting next week, let's just kind of use somebody like that for an example, because there's probably many people who listen to this who might find themselves in front of a judge or who will be finding themselves in front of a judge. So what's the advice? And I don't know how that would transcribe to Ireland, but for yourselves in the UK, how would you give that advice? For the LIT, for the guy who's
the litigant in person, the LIP. So basically, once you go into the system, once you've been charged, you've been arrested, it's very scary. And I'll just put out there to everybody who goes through that in the initial stages, please understand that the fear factor is actually the objective here. It's the old "we'll scare you straight" tactic, which never bloody worked, right? But they'll keep doing it. So they're using this fear tactic. So they'll have you sitting there in the seat, in your cuffs, and they'll be staring you down saying, oh, you know, this is serious and we're going to do this, and they're going to process you. And then you're going to go down, they'll fingerprint you, and then, you know, you won't have your belt on. You'll be holding your pants up as they take your photo, shoelaces out and all of that type of stuff. Proper, you know, make sure that the animal is kept in check. And the reality being is, you know, this is a human being treated very, very unfairly. Once you've gone through all that, well, that's when the process starts, doesn't it? You know, the incident has occurred, and then you'll get your date for your what's known as a preliminary diet, which will determine what they're going to do with you, insofar as are you going to contest it? Is it a guilty plea? Is it a not guilty plea? Et cetera, et cetera. They'll look at the information. The judge may send you away for things like a interview with a counselor to determine sort of the head, the mindset, to find out if they're a threat to society, et cetera, especially in a scenario where there's no violence, but there's a large quantity. They'll probably send that down for them to assess whether or not that, you know, that you're a nefarious individual or you've got, you know, problems that they need to consider. And you'll go through all of these things. And the reality is when you get to it, depending on the quantity and how it's being used, you'll fall into either a fine or community service, custodial if it's very big, usually on the 6 months, you know, down to 3 months for good behavior or three time served. But very rarely do they sort of criminalize smaller stuff, you know, custodial for smaller things. So a joint, a bag of weed, a small crop, those types of things, you're looking at a fine and community service at most. Yeah. Now, that's a huge amount of money being made out of our community, out of our people, you know what I mean? Out of cannabis users. We're being harmed, we're being robbed. Yeah. Because it's low hanging fruit, you see? It's easy. Does a cop want to go running in and pulling out 20 children who are being abused by an organized crime gang that might be tooled up with weapons and that, or just go and get a guy down there who's got a crop on and they reach their quota.
Yep.
You know, it's a question we have to ask. I'm not, now, please understand that I'm not saying that to discount that what the police do. All right. And I must say that there are good police out there. There are good police out there, but there are bad police. You know, and also what we've got is the bad police allowed to be there because the system is not being managed properly. Actually, we've got a great system on paper. When you read the PACE code, when you read our laws, when you read our, you know, the our constitution, and you read what is supposed to happen. Actually, I always sit there and go, can we have this, please? What you told us that we're getting? The reality is different to the theory. So when you go in, you're going through this process, you've got coppers who have absolutely no idea on what they're doing. So you ask them that question. This is what I say to people. Ask them the three questions from the start and then shut up. Deal with it later when you're actually going into to handling your case. But just say, can you please provide the evidence of the Schedule 2 Class B charge that you're arresting me on? They will sit there and go, we're not playing that game.
I asked them for that repeatedly the other night when I was sitting in the cell, and they refused to hand it over. I even told them that I had FOI responses from Durham Police, the CPS, and the Home Office that they couldn't verify the charges. I was told by the one of the guys in the custody suite that I didn't have any of that.
It's Jedi mind tricks now. It's like, provide the evidence because we've got this. Well, no, you don't. We'll just wipe the mind and just... Wait a minute, because we're looking at something different. And really where it comes down to for the arrest stage, this is another key point. You've got three questions. What is the foundation evidence of the Schedule 2 Class B listing? Okay, yep. That's the first question. The second one is, where is the evidence for claim of misuse? How am I misusing it? You know, how is it being misused in this context? Well, it's, you know, people use it for organized crime, but how am I using it, misusing it? How am I using it for organized crime? You need to prove, they need to prove that. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then you've got, what is the claim for, you know, what is the evidence for the claim of control? Because if they say they control it, yet I can go and grow it, they don't have any control over it. It's nature. How do they control nature? Mm-hmm. How do they control nature? Yeah, that's the other significant question. Now, when they say, well, we're, you know, that's we'll leave that for the courts. It's nothing to do with us. Just go, are you operating under your police attestation? And they will have to say yes, because they have to. Whenever they're on shift, they're operating under their police attestation. So then all you need to do is, before they arrest you, go, well, hold on a second, you're in breach of PACE code G, section 1.3, which means full justification. You need to be fully justified in being able to arrest somebody. So if I'm showing you that you can't provide evidence, and here's an LOI or an FOI, sorry, an FOI from the Home Office saying they destroyed the evidence, then you are not fully justified.
Yeah.
And actually you're in breach. So you now are no longer operating under the police banner because you've stepped outside of your code of conduct, which means that you're now liable individually as a police officer for personal and civil charges from me as a public member for acts of, fraud, blackmail, because they're basically asking for money at that stage. They're arresting you and you're going to get processed and the court's going to sit there and go, 200 quid fine, and this all goes away. You know,
I'm going to put it in there a second, mate, because that 200 quid fine, you've got to remember that all fines go to pay police pensions. So this is why they go after those fines. It's their pension pots that we're financing.
Oh, yeah.
Are we happy with that as a public?
Like, but does that not show like a bit of a bias there for their need to go out and get these fines?
It's a breach of integrity.
Such a low-hanging fruit in there as well.
That's the carrot, isn't it?
The case in Ireland.
It's a breach of integrity as a public life.
Yeah,
there's ways around it. Can make the police a hell of a lot more money through a regulated industry than we can through them just fining people. And certainly we'll be wanting better police public relations, which is what we're trying to work towards. But what we get is we get this ignorance and ego, and it's the Lucifer effect. If you've ever read the book, The Lucifer Effect, it's the same thing. Give me a badge, give me authority. I'm right, you're wrong.
I'm going to put one more time there. You know what you were doing? Saying about telling the policeman about that attestation, all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I actually did that when the police were here the other day. I tried to show them evidence, and they refuse to act on it. They refuse to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
So there's evidence that you're committing fraud. We're going to completely ignore that. Yeah. We're going to take it to the station, and apparently my arrest has been lawful.
Yeah, I would suggest that anybody who is involved in cannabis is go and read Pace Code B, start to finish, and you'll actually see what they should be doing. You see what they should be doing. It's actually on paper. They sign up to it. It's an attestation. We do this, because that. If I read it, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. But at the time of arrest, they're not following that. So what we've done is we've set the foundation to try to stop the arrest. So if someone's well versed enough, but the thing is, they can turn around and do exactly what Trev said, completely ignore you and arrest you anyway. But if you've got at that stage, they always say, anything you say can and will be used against you. Just ask the three questions. So they're recorded at that stage. So mm-hmm. then as you bring your case forward, you know what I mean? You're presenting the same evidence based on those three questions, which we know, ethically and truthfully, they don't have a leg to stand on. Yeah. So anything else out with that is either corruption, ignorance, or malfeasance.
So, with yourself, Trev, are you going to be actually bringing cases against? I've seen you kind of named and shamed some of those PCs or whatever you call them.
I'm going after every single one of them. I'm going from civil court or not. I'm pressing charges against the force. And I'm dragging for me witnesses when I go to court. I'm going to be dragging in all of the coppers involved in the bus. I'm going to question them personally, and I'm also going to call in Joe Farrell and Steve White, who are my chief of police and PCVC, and I'm going to put both of them on the stand and question them as well.
Excellent. That sounds like an interesting affair. I hope that all goes well, and I hope it really puts
they're the ones who have done this. So it's them that are going to get put in front of a judge.
Yeah, well, it's well within your civil rights anyway to kind of do this and take them to the court for these kind of violations against yourself. I really look forward. I'm going to have to look at our own Garda Oath here in Ireland to see
You do know this case is already in effect over in Northern Ireland, don't you?
I do. I've heard of
there's two of the lads who have already been to court, and they've asked the same three questions. Foundation evidence for Schedule 1, foundation evidence for claim of control, foundation evidence for misuse. In both cases, the judges have turned around to the PPS, and said, I want answers to those questions as well.
Because he doesn't know.
Cases are on hold right now until the answers are interesting.
Exactly.
Because we've never challenged the route, you see. This is when we talk about regulations, CBD, industry, THC, recreational, and all that stuff. It's all built off like this, medical, recreational, industrial. This is illegal. That's not. This is. If you've got a license, then that stuff that's illegal is not illegal anymore because you've been able to come up with $250,000 for your product. Right? So it's a financial barrier of entry. But the problem with that in commercial industries, you don't go to jail for not being able to meet those barriers of entry. In this instance, we do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that is that. That irks me personally. Obviously, it irks Trevor. It irks Guy. It irks every Seed Our Future member. It irks anybody who has a love for the plant or an affinity or a relationship with the plant in whatever fashion that may be. I mean, my big thing is about education, with Flora Fusion, sorry, shameless plug for my CBD company. Our ethos is educate, supply, and support. So I don't want, me personally, but our company doesn't want someone coming in and just buying a bottle because they heard CBD was good. You know what I mean? Because it's like, well, yeah, but do you know why? And are you on medications? Have you considered this? Have you done that? And they always, our customers always walk away going, I knew nothing of that. And that's encouraging because that's what it is. It's the ignorance and lack of education, in the public, which as you convert somebody, it's a beautiful thing. You get a tingly feeling because you're like, that person, they listened to the truth and they were able to adapt. It gives you hope and humanity because people just, If you don't know what you know, what do we do as a natural human existential crisis characteristic of ours is we destroy it. I don't understand it, so I just want to destroy it because that's better. It's better that it's not there than me not understanding what it is. So in this instance, if someone's not too sure about cannabis, all they've ever heard was say no to drugs. cannabis is harmful.
Yeah.
You've got an MP, someone they're looking to, who gets up and goes, clear evidence of harm. Okay, cool. Provide the evidence or we destroyed it. What?
What annoyed me over the years is people...
Well, evidence is a crime itself.
But there was the many patients who found of the medical benefits of cannabis through the internet because our governments, our health officials, they're not really telling us the truth, unfortunately. And they learn about, say, the Rick Simpson oils and all of the other kind of campaigners out there who are pushing kind of oils for patients. And then they go and they source them on the black market. Like Jeff Ditchfield is a person who I was kind of following his campaign.
Bud Buddies.
Bud Buddies, exactly. Yeah. And I'm going to
dive in a second there. And I'm going to say he's a big inspiration for me with the Seed Our Future document, because it was his saying that kind of drove this. Mm. Be an expert on every law you intend to break. Is what I've done with Morda. Yes,
100%. Yeah, I would agree with that as well. Yeah. Can I ask on that point, actually, with the Seed Our Future campaign, I know you're going to be supporting people who go to court, but are you going to be proactive? So, like, challenge the law, say, similar to what I was kind of hoping to do here myself.
Okay, on this, I'm going to honor a request from our founder, Guy Coxall, and just say that something big is coming. Can't tell you about it yet.
Oh, no.
I do apologize. No, but let's just say that we're putting something in. It's one of these things, is, you know, Sun Tzu. Let's keep our cards close to our chest until we're ready. But yes, please know that we're not working in the background as a bunch of guys who are just like, yeah, man, we're actually challenging the law, using the law itself. So the law is the law, right? We have these laws, and what are the laws? They're the rules, aren't they? The rules are the rules, right? The rules are the rules. The government is the voice of the people. Mm-hmm. The police were built. So Robert Peel, the Peelers, as the Northern Irish call it, the Peelers. I love that. Peel, when he built the police, he made it clear in his 10 kind of points. I think it's 10 or 12. Sorry, forgive me on that one. But he states that the police must be the public. It must be, because that's how it works. And all police are is, back in the day when the police were, you know, in the late 1800s, society was very, very, you know, you knew what your neighbor was up to. Everyone knew what was going, and everyone was looked at with this sort of like almost critical eye on how they acted as an individual, how they represented themselves. Like you say, child out of wedlock. Oh, that's a faux pas, because it's not, you know, it's either not Christian or Catholic or probably, you know, or whatever. It's not religious to do that. And then what we've got is, at that time, if someone went and beat this is pre-police. If someone went and beat their wife in the local village, where, you know what I mean, they go and sort them out themselves. Mm-hmm. Right? If someone did, a kid did something nefarious in the local community, didn't matter if it was your child or not, you gave them a clip over the ear and you said, boy, that's not the way we do it. Peel understood this and realized, actually, we need a kind of group of people who are going to do that all the time as a job, as opposed to everyone having to be a cop all the time. We're going to elevate people in society to do that, to keep that in check, to keep the social order. But they are the public. They're just normal people, but we give them a badge to say, don't you worry about going and dealing with that guy's bit of, like, I'm doing it. It's my job. You know, I'm a big lad and I can do that. And they used to, the old bobbies, mate, they used to give you a hiding. You did something wrong. Some drunk walking home, causing a ruckus, waking people up. They go give him a hiding. And then, you know, maybe chuck him in the lockup for the night and then maybe give him a kick up the ass as they're letting him out the next day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What's happened is it's no longer the people. The police are not working. They're now a corporation. And that corporation can be bought. The corporation that, you know, in Scotland, it's Police Scotland Limited, who now work for the UK Government Limited. You know, we've lost sight of what the purpose is. We've lost sight of what the purpose of the police is. We've allowed the government to become no longer our voice. They're no longer our voice. We're being dictated to. It's like, okay, it's 2 million people that say we want to use cannabis. Back in the old days, it would have been like, and I'm talking about pre-1930s, it would have been, well, there's 2 million people that want it. How do we work around to make sure that they're all right? But obviously, you know, that we're filling in all the nuances of that being integrated. Mm-hmm. And the people who don't want anything to do with cannabis, making sure that that's, you know, that everyone's cool, society would work it out. But no, what we've got is too many agendas, too many different kind of boardrooms, mm-hmm. I would say, too many boardrooms affecting changes or legal sort of frameworks, which do not suit the majority of the public. And that has to change. So I believe I'm in a democracy. I'm going to continue on optimistic our future campaign, which I can't talk about, to the next. We've got to fall back on the system actually was designed properly in a sense, but we're just misusing it. Yeah. You know, if there's any misuse going on, it's in the systems itself, which is there to protect us. And it's no longer protecting us. We're being victimized. Yeah. So, and I mean, I'm speaking on behalf of the cannabis community as like an individual segregated from someone who doesn't use cannabis, or what someone might say is a upstanding citizen. Mm-hmm. But I've seen those upstanding citizens get absolutely leathered and make an absolute tit of themselves.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
If you go back
and, if
you were to go back to those pre-1930 times as well, before drug prohibition came in, like there was no drug gangs, like and all of the violence associated.
There wasn't at all.
I'm going to disagree with you there, mate, because the British Empire were one of the biggest drug dealers. If you look at the opium wars in China, that was all us that started that off. The British have been the biggest drug dealers in the world. We're still the biggest drug dealers in the world. We're the number one exporter of pharmaceuticalized cannabis, pharmaceuticalized heroin, pharmaceuticalized cocaine.
Yeah. But the harm of prohibition gets added to the potential harm of the drug. So if we think about the X integer of if it's legal without the peripheral damage that can be caused through legislation and prohibition, if you had X integer of people that would be harmed by, say, abuse, drug abuse, addiction, could be circumstantial, you know, that's the escape mechanism, the social health issues of drugs, and they've made that criminal, you would have them anyway. And I keep saying, like, what was the purpose of the drug war? What was the purpose of it? To stop drugs entering society. Really? You're lost. You can't keep them out of prisons. If you can't keep him out of the prison, you're going to keep him out of society. It's just ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
It was never, ever about the drugs. It was all about the control system. The Nixon administration had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people, and they used drugs to demonize them. That is the foundations of your terrorist accusations.
It's actually legalizing slavery, because if you look at 1930s and back then, it was only 60 years ago. So it's like our 1950s. That's when slavery was still about back over there, right? So
the 13th Amendment in the Constitution, in the American Constitution, allowed for that. Any criminals, anybody caught with criminals, could be put into indentured servitude.
That's right. So use something like cannabis, you can easily make a criminal. By 1952, you had chain gangs of prisoners doing the work cheap for companies.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've just... it's happening over here. Companies like Speedy Hire, when somebody goes and gets sent to prison, it costs £65,000 to send them there. It then costs £40,000 per year to keep them there. At which point, companies like Speedy Hire take them on at 50 pence per hour, undermining legitimate jobs and wages. So that's happening in this country as much as it is in America.
Jeez, well, in America, they just signed off something there. Was it yesterday or the day before with your man Biden kind of ending this private prison system that they have there or something? I don't know enough about it to comment on it, but I seen kind of that headline. He's going to ending the private prison system.
He's also shutting down Keystone XL.
Yeah. Where does it?
He's shutting down Keystone XL as well, which is also a massive one for us.
Okay.
Because what's going to replace oil?
Well, yeah, hopefully, yeah, cannabis and biofuels.
As long as it's a free market, as long as it's a free market and doesn't get, like, we need anti-monopolization policies, because it's quite easy to monopolize cannabis if you got the right, if you got the money to get all the licensing. Yeah. But no, it's the people's plant. Yeah. So if you're asking an individual to choose between breaking the law or saving their kid's life, and then you criminalize them for choosing to save their kid's life, well, then I'm sorry, you're not a human being. You're not. You know what I mean? Sure. You might be acting in a role which gives you some sort of ability to sleep at night. Like, I am a police officer, I am a lawyer, I am a judge. I'm like, oh yeah, so when you were born, it was, oh, look at this bouncing baby police officer that's popped out. It's not how it works, mate. No. You're a human being acting in a role that is agreed in society as being legitimate and valid. If you're going to use that to then, you know, I don't know, look down on your fellow human being, not, you know, if you're a police officer, you're there to protect the public against, and if someone's sitting there rolling around drunk or heavily on drugs or something, well, how the hell do you know what they've gone through that's put them in that frame of mind? What is the sequence of events that's got them there? Do we put them in a jail? So someone who's become almost like feral in their experiences for whatever purposes, what we do is we cage them and make sure that we really drive home that they're an animal. No, it's not how we do it. And that's not to say that people don't have a responsibility as well, right? I'm not discounting that people don't have a responsibility in their own existence. And certainly when it comes to, you know, operating in society, harming other people, yeah, you've got to take onus. But we've got to support rehabilitation, not drive it further to make it worse and worse and worse each time, and then sit there and go, look at us, we're heroes, we're stopping crime. Nah, especially when they, you know, jump online and they show a couple of bags of weed and go, look at this bus, and you're like, wow.
I'll be watching the Twitter feed. There are some of those Northern Irish police that they really love winding people up, like, and I think the police are just straight up trolls online when they're posting some of these things, because they know they're, like, again, poking the hornet's nest. Like,
I would get every police officer to read a book called The Lucifer Effect. They should be mandatory in police training to read that book and understand how easily it is for authority to strip into power, or the power better or more, you know, than another human being, regardless of their status. They ain't got there yet.
Yeah,
because that's not the case. Treat the CEO the same as the guy who's sweeping the floor. They're all both human beings in different roles. He gets paid more. He gets paid less. So who should we treat better? Not the guy that's going to go home to his luxury house. The guy that's going to go home to his two kids that he's sitting there sweeping the floor because that's what he's doing, and he's going to go back. These are the people we should be putting on the pedestal as heroes. The ones who every day go out and still maintain integrity and honor, even with less than those who are in positions who should be leading the way. That's not to say how they're better in society. And I think cannabis legislation, the drug war itself, huge amount of issues in most societies throughout the world that it needs to be addressed if we're going to see peace at any time. You know, peace in our time is what we want.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, you've got kids. What do you want? You want a better world for your kids, right? So if we look at this, the drug war's been going for, well, yeah, I think you could take it back to 1928. Then, if you take it back, that's how long this war's been going. No war lasts that long.
No, definitely.
You know what I mean?
No. It's an ongoing war within the victims, because effectively it's just criminalizing us for our human nature. But they're selective then in who they actually target in our society. As we kind of see in America, the numbers don't lie. It's like Black and Hispanic people end up in prison and incarcerated because of it more. Here in Ireland, my own experience is, you know, be a young fella wearing a hoodie going around the place, you're going to get stopped and searched a lot more than the fella wearing a suit going down the road. But even though the fellow with the suit going down the road is more likely,
he's doing the exact same thing as the young lad.
Yeah. Or something like, or even a bag of weed too, like, you know. But yeah, definitely, it's just discriminatory right across the board.
Absolutely. And it needs to stop.
Yeah, what you said earlier is rules are rules. Like, I think after talking with you here now today and after getting a good understanding of the Seed Our Future campaign, and I think definitely if our Gardaí don't have an oath similar to what your ears do over there, we do have a constitution here in Ireland which has our human rights enshrined in it through the human
ECHR you operate on.
That's it, the ECHR, that's the one. And within that, there's actually a prohibition on discrimination. And like you could look at the medical cannabis patients, how they're discriminated against here in Ireland. They have to travel over to Holland to get their medicines. Well, they don't anymore because of the virus, but like it's discrimination. I can't see how you couldn't call it anything but discrimination. So I think all of these people have a case against the people 100%. Discriminating against them, which are the enforcers of the Misuse of Drugs Act, the prohibition, the government, and all of the above, you know.
Something needs to change at some point soon. We're not. I think the momentum is building, and when you know, it's not seed our future. Is you know, they're coming out of the blue there, and no one's really thought of this. We have actually. No, people have been fighting. We're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
In so far as the movement in the cannabis, there's some guys in you know been in prison for the last 25 years because they had a crop on at the wrong time in history. And, you know, and then they're going to come out into a market whereby, hold on a second, the guys that put me in prison are now profiting heavily off what I got jailed for.
Yeah, that it's just like backwards.
Don't take that deal. I'm just going to say that to all members of the public. If you get arrested for cannabis, don't take the deal because it's not a good one. Right? Yeah. You're in the right. They have no legal foundations. Now, I want to go back to when we're talking about harm. Cannabis, if overused, you've ever had a whitey, Martin? Does anyone, talk about a whitey, Australians will call it greening out. Australians will call it greening out and all that type of stuff. There's different versions of healing. And what that is too much THC. Obviously, a counter to that is to have some CBD to help balance that out. That you know, the science will state that CBD will help to lessen the impact of THC onto the receptors, specifically the endocannabinoid system, CB1 and CB2. A whitey is just the downregulation of your endocannabinoid system. Once you go too much, it will just basically switch off. In a sense, it will down. You know, it will just go. You're fucked at me. Yeah, I'm shutting down. And what do you feel? You feel nauseous. You're sweating. You're pale. Someone will say you're looking a bit green there, mate. Which is where we get the green out. And then you know you need to lie down. You'll sink into the couch, and then about 6 hours later, you'll come back out. Now, if you do that to yourself every day, you can actually fall into a thing called cannabis hyperemesis. And cannabis hyperemesis is a vomiting bug. And that can actually be quite harmful in the sense of like, yeah, you'll lose weight. You're going to need to get on a saline drip and et cetera. And you're going to need to rehydrate. And you're going to need to do all these things and get through that. So that's the spectrum of harm.
But the reality is, though, if cannabis did that to you, you're very probably rare. Not going to do it the next day, though. Like if that's your 100%. First experience and your second and your third, you're not
going
to do
you ain't
it.
Going back.
Five. You're like, because it's not that addictive. You know what I mean? No. It's not going to keep you coming back if it's going to do that to you.
Yeah. Yeah. No one's going to be addicted to a whitey.
So
but we know that same individual with the right amount may have felt a completely different effect. Right. And certainly, I know when I was a kid, they always go, oh, it creates paranoia and anxiety and all that. My paranoia and anxiety was always about getting caught, not about what I was doing. It was about getting caught. That's where I was, you know, pinpoint the time when I said, you know, oh, gee, God, I hope my life is centered around actually fighting for cannabis at one point. And I was only 17 when I asked this. It's because me and my friends were stoned on a street corner and a police car drove past. One of them's in a cab on the way home and the other one's legging it away. And I'm just standing there with my bloodshot eyes going, what are we doing? What's actually going on here? Like what? You know, and this was after being raised in Australia, which is very much a drinking culture. You know what I mean? So at 14, sneaking a beer, that was all right. But sneaking a joint, nah, that's no good. Right? However, drinking the beer at 14, 15 years of age has me rolling down hills in all sorts of states. And then when I first, and I was actually I'm going to put my hand up. I was anti-cannabis for about the first, 50, you know, the 6 years of my youth. And from like, say, 9, I got hit with the say no to drugs with the parents and I believed it. By the age of 15 and my mates are all having a toke, I'm sitting there going, you guys are doing the wrong thing because I've been brainwashed. I said, if you just keep that up, you'll become junkies. And then I said it a few times. I put my hand up and admit it to this day. But a mate of mine came up and goes, you know, you can't really say that unless you tried it. You know, so the pressure has started. And I'm sitting there going, well, there's logic to that. I can't knock it till I try it. And that was it was like a penny drop. You know, sat there, smoked, had a billy actually, a little, you know, we made out of an orky bottle, an orange juice bottle, and it was this really sort of basic thing. But then when I had it, I felt, you know, just laughed and laughed and laughed. You know, the feelings, laughed, relaxed, absolute bell of a time. And then didn't feel the hangover, didn't feel like I'd been hit with by a ton of bricks the next day. And that's what set me in the motion of, what else are they lying about?
Yes. No,
they lied to us here.
I was in the same boat as myself, that I can remember having a conversation with my cousin on the bus, and I've kind of talked about this a couple of times before, but like saying to him, like, oh, geez, what are you smoking hash for? It's going to rot your brain and things. And like, no, I remember being up in the Glen then not too long after that conversation, maybe within the 2 weeks, and him just being like, yeah, there, just try it, like, it's not that bad. And I tried it, and I really enjoyed it, like, and my experience was, by and large, it was very positive. I didn't get caught with it. I didn't get, that was about 15, similar to yourself, and I didn't get caught with it until I was 17. So I never really had like that issue with the law, but we were certainly stopped and searched a couple of times because of the area, so we did see the effect of it. But when I got caught with it, then the worst part of getting caught with it was having the guards call to my house with a summons. My mom and dad got very bad about that. They were more upset about the fact the guards came to my house than they were about me getting caught.
You actually using cannabis.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the reality that even youth today have to fall in. It's just like, well, we're not learning anything, you know what I mean? Because that wasn't cool for me, you know, and at the next gen, we don't want the same thing for them.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want kids who potentially have a bright future, you know, smoking some cannabis, and then that future being stripped away from them because of the wider mechanisms that they have no involvement in. That's not cool. Don't care what you do to me. You know what I mean? I'm 42, you know, give me another 30 years, I'm checking out. But we've got to really think about the decisions we're making here for future generations.
Yeah.
And that we can't perpetuate something like the drug war. We can't be advocates for something that's failed. You know what I mean? Let's be a smarter species, you know, and do things different. So, but yeah, I guess we'll see the future when it comes to what's coming up. You know, watch this space. There are exciting things.
Yeah,
we are trying to.
And delighted to hear that, because I can't wait to see what you have in the bag to be pulled out, because. I'm even more excited now, like, and even the response you've gotten, Trevor, since you shared your posts and stuff, like, the community is really
about that. This in the last couple of days, I'm excited as fuck about it, like. I've got to say a massive thank you to everybody in the cannabis community for the response I've had, because everybody, I mean, I've been offered kit, money, support in any way, shape, or form that I need, because everybody knows I'm going to fight this every way I can. So I really, the response has been absolutely outstanding. For somebody who spends a lot of time alone, I've felt completely alone for a long, long time, but no more.
Yeah. Well, I think the ethos of Studio Future is unity is our shield. The
appreciation that you have shown, the support that you have shown,
since I came
everything
into
that you have offered,
the organizations that's been taken on, you know, with a very strong commitment by not only the sort of managers, directors, and people who are involved in the operational side of things, but the community itself, is because, you know, it's the cannabis community industry whole thing has been victims of fragmentation. You know what I mean? Yeah. Egotistical fragmentation for whatever purposes. That's not the way to do it. One organism working together against the wider, you know, for an objective is a hell of a lot more powerful than 20 different people all saying the same thing in a different way.
Exactly. Right?
Let's not do that, because we all want the same thing. So let's forget that. Let's bring it together. It's one organization. It's one community represented by anybody who's willing to get going. If someone turned around tomorrow and said, look, I can dedicate 16 hours to see our future, where do you want me? Right? We'll find something for you to do. You know what I mean? Like, at the moment, we're not fiscally orientated. we will be, and I'll plant the seed now, we will be generating a revenue model because this has all been self-funded. Me personally, I probably, you know, I left my public sector job. I'm focusing heavily in on this. I don't have an income and I've got my savings. And I know Trev has put everything he can in. Guy Coxall is the same. We're not making money in this. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do is reach the end game, which is actual freedom of cannabis under a safe and regulated and fair policy system, which meets safety standards. Mm-hmm. In a world with no jobs, we're trying to create jobs.
Which would allow each and every one of us to work legitimately and contribute massive amounts to our tax, to the tax coffers that would regenerate everything.
Jeez.
And the right way to do it is actually go into the prisons and find out who has been victimized under these laws, find out who it is that's actually requiring reparations,
multiple skills and
disciplines. And then, you know, and these guys need to be looked after. They need to be brought, and I'm not talking about your violent criminals, like I've got a cannabis charge and, you know, 16 rapes and 14 murders. No, you don't qualify for a Seed Our Future defense. We're talking, we know who we're talking about, and that's who we're trying to protect.
That's right.
That is already happening in the States. What you're finding is that they're expunging records right the way back to the 70s. They're reimbursing fines, they're reimbursing confiscations.
A lot of money.
And because they've got nobody who can do the work as well as those that they've criminalized, they're now getting those big money jobs. So a regular gardener, you're looking at around about $100,000 a year. A master gardener, $250,000 a year.
But the reality is, meanwhile,
a copper who busted them, they're driving by them with a nice big spliff in the mouth and a nice big car.
That copper's still on 55 grand a year. Victimized by, say, you know, the rest of society. And that's exactly what's happening here. You know, like I say, not giving the game away, but about it, because we don't want half us talk about it. We're going to present it in a fashion that hopefully everyone will understand, will be able to get behind, and the end game on that directive will be something that we've never seen before. And that's fingers crossed. We will do our darndest.
Thanks very much for taking the time here, because unless there's anything else you'd like to get out, I think we really talked it over, and I'm definitely going to follow back up to you. So yourself,
I know, I think we got that.
Following very closely. I was chatting there recently with Gary Hughes up above in Liverpool.
Oh, I love Gary.
Yeah, he's hoping to open up his chilling rooms once your restrictions ease there. So I'm going to get on the first ferry I can across.
Brilliant!
Get all that stuff on. So
let's all meet up there and get we'll get a little panel podcast after we've got some more information, and we'll have a good laugh.
I'm always up for a trip to Liverpool. It's a fucking great city.
Excellent.
You'll have to beat these things out, Martin. We've got these bloody potty mouths.
We've a poor audience. Once we didn't person the first 5 minutes, YouTube algorithms don't mind.
Well, I'm an Australian painter decorator by trade, so I grew up on building sites as an Aussie, so me not swearing is pretty much impossible. It doesn't work.
I'm half Scottish, half Geordie.
I think with your accents anyway, YouTube won't be able to translate it.
we'll get away with it. Thank you very much for having us, Martin. Much appreciated, mate.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. Seedourfuture.co.uk. And any other particular places you want to send people? Is there Facebook, Instagram?
Flora-fusion.co.uk for the old CBD brand. They can have a look on that and our Trustpilot, and have a look at all the people whose lives we've been impacted in a positive way.
Excellent. Guys, thanks very much again, and enjoy the rest of your day. I really look forward to getting to edit this later.
Thank you very much, Martin. Much appreciated.
Easy, you're in.
Bye.
In a bit, man.
Bye. Ciao.
And there you go, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that interview there with Trev Coleman and Steve Harrison of the Seed Our Future campaign. Really exciting to hear that they have something planned. I was was that they weren't able to spill the beans with us. Maybe if I held off on the interview for another week or so, I would have been a bit more appropriately timed. But look, nonetheless, definitely go check out the cedarfuture.co.uk. It's their website. And I think they're up on Facebook and other places there as well. So definitely keep an eye out on them. I'll be keeping an eye out on them anyway. And as soon as they spill the beans on whatever it is they've planned, I'll certainly bring that news to yourselves out there, guys. So thanks everybody for tuning into the show, and I hope you enjoyed the interview, and stay blazed out there, guys, and keep her lit. Peace.